Projection.
Hey, welcome to Taking It Down, the TV and streaming podcast from the Alabama Take. We give thoughts that range from complex to simple, from analytical to basic about shows and movies on TV. I'm Blaine Duncan, editor-in-chief of the website The Alabama Take. I've always enjoyed determining why I like and dislike things, and I have a little bit of a side hustle as an English teacher, so hopefully that lends itself to our busy listeners who want some insight. It's great for listeners that it's not just me breaking down what you want to know. It's Adam Morrow, our erudite touring and studio musician who keeps up with fine literature, Donovan Reinwald, who specializes in media at a New England college and loves film, old books, and more. And Natalie Morrow, she's the first person to go to about fantasy, sci-fi, comics, trashy reality TV, and Beyonce's music. We're here for lovers of television who are just too busy for anything more than the series or movie itself, or maybe for the person who just does not want the typical critic or Hollywood adjacent analysis. Plus, like a lot of Alabama Take productions, we're high quality. We actually think. Let's get into the show. Welcome. No Natalie this week. She is in the intro. You heard her name. She's not with us. She had some technical issues, really. If anybody wants to donate a computer and an internet service and you...
entire internet infrastructure, Florence.
Hit us up.
Are we back on this? My town has functioning internet.
Are you sure of this? You know, you haven't provided much evidence. Oh, which was going to be the segment where Natalie and I talked about Loki. Yeah, that's right. So no Loki this week. We've both seen every episode of the second season, and we'll tuck that away for you maybe. That does take us to our first segment. We are a TV and streaming podcast, but that's first and foremost. It was Thanksgiving, though. We had time to slip out of the house and away from the TV to see Napoleon.
Let me tell you something.
Yeah.
You're making it seem like I found opportunity to go see Napoleon. Pal, when dudes are lined up shooting guns at each other, we create the opportunity to go see that.
And who can blame you?
I was at the me and every boomer couple in the Shoals was at the first showing at 3 o'clock in the afternoon of Napoleon on Tuesday afternoon.
We're no boomers. We're close. But that's who I was in company with. I saw it on Thanksgiving Day. There's no better time to see a movie. Ridley Scott is back with some historical accuracy. I think he flipped his middle finger at that idea.
Wait, are you telling me the events of Gladiator are not entirely factual?
To my knowledge, no.
I've been editing Wikipedia wrong, then.
Adam sends his apologies. So we got epic battles, lots of surprisingly funny scenes from Joaquin Phoenix being a weird little guy. And we're going to get into it. If you don't want your history spoiled, this is not your podcast segment, let me tell you. I think the movie should have gone for the throat here. It could have even been more humorous. It could have done that, not just a straight-up comedy, or the tongue-in-cheekiness that was present sometimes did not feel as devoted to the bit, which is not to say, again, it didn't need to be a comedy. There's no way it could be a comedy with those kinds of set pieces. I got a chuckle in a weird kind of way. What'd you make of the comedy of the odd humor?
Natalie told me about I believe it was IndieWire. So whoever wrote for them wrote that it was one of the funniest things that they've seen lately, but they weren't sure that it always meant to be. I'm not sure, with only having skimmed that article, I won't take too much of a beef with it. I think it knew it was trying to be funny. I think Joaquin Phoenix knew, like you said in the intro, that he was just being a weird little guy.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some just really funny, uncomfortable scenes, especially in the Josephine-Napoleon courtship.
Right.
So funny.
As for Joaquin Phoenix's choices, I did like that he and Ridley Scott made Napoleon maybe less arrogant and smarmy and more afraid. You know, there's this idea of a Napoleonic complex and even short man syndrome, which that's just based in fear. And that's at play here, I think. And it was seen maybe for the first time in a Napoleon portrayal. Maybe not the first time. You know, he switches to this quiet confidence in the war scene. And just paranoid little guy in every other scene.
Yeah, it's like the one thing that he's good at happens to get him, you know, elevated to status of emperor eventually. But even in that first battle scene, he's playing it as if, like, I felt really good about this plan until it started. Oh my God, what have I done? Kind of like, please work, for the love of God, please work. And he has a line at some point he says, like, I never tried to be anything. I never tried to, people keep like saying he should do these things, and he kind of just does it because he has the forward momentum of whatever victory he has or blah, blah, blah. Donovan can weigh in on the historical accuracy of such a portrayal, but it was, instead of just having like a swashbuckling kind of badass, having somebody who mm-hmm. is kind of just swept up in his own myth was an interesting choice.
I mean, it's hard to say, right? Especially for this time in his life. You only have what people who were around him, and so many of them were so dazzled by, you know, he was a larger-than-life figure. I mean, you look at the old man on St. Helena, and he certainly seems to have, like Adam said, kind of bought into his own myth a little bit. But, I mean, he'd lost it all at that point.
Well, exactly. What else?
Or did I say St. Helena? I think he was out in Elba the second time.
No, you had it.
I'm mixing it up.
Yeah, you had it right. Elba the first time.
Elba the first time. Okay.
Let me tell you, I'll get an exile to Elba, Alabama.
That's, no, it's, oh, it's oh, tough. It wasn't Alabama. Did you pick up on that? It's not Alabama.
That wasn't Elba, Alabama?
Mm-mm. Wow. No. Yeah.
My memory's getting a little faulty.
Shaky in your old age.
Mm-hmm. My overall feelings were that the movie kind of felt like a historical checklist of sorts rather than a movie with something to say. But I think maybe it had a little bit to say about who he was. It plotted a little. Did I like it? Yeah, I did, because it was a part of history I don't know a lot about. So even if it's just a historical checklist for me, seeing it on screen was fun. Well, I think you probably liked it a lot more than I.
I enjoyed it, and I am, like I said at the top, just a sucker for like big set piece battles. I mean, to keep it in the Ridley Scott verse, if I see the Gladiator has just kicked off on cable, it's got me for the first half hour.
Absolutely.
Battle in the snow, it's so good.
But Gladiator isn't as slow as this one.
No, Gladiator's an almost perfectly paced mm-hmm. film. Napoleon, when you were talking just now, the first thing I thought of was how often there's text on screen
right.
explaining something.
A lot.
And obviously it's a much more, not to keep comparing it to Gladiator, but to compare it to Gladiator one more time. There's a lot more actual, like he can play with the Gladiator story a lot more than, like, to drop you in the middle of the French Revolution and try to like set the stage with some pretty complex politics.
It's tough.
Is a tall task, and I appreciate that he just was like, screw it, I'll just write what I need people to know on the screen so that I can advance the story instead of trying to like show, don't tell. But the fact that he needed to do that was indicative of like a, this is tough to yeah. really set the stage and just like fully have you there.
Agreed. I'll compare it to another Ridley Scott film I can contrast because of length, Blade Runner. Take Blade
Wow,
Runner.
I was about to make a joke about Blade Runner and then
okay. well,
jumped right in
that
there.
Movie. Blade Runner's long and can feel long even as you're watching it, but it's also examining some pretty dark pieces of humanity. This Napoleon movie was long, felt long, and I just never felt like it was pinpointing what it wanted to put under the microscope. Maybe that behind every buffoon, there's a strong woman. I got that a lot, but yeah. just, and I think I know why I felt this way is I loved Joaquin Phoenix's portrayal, but he felt so much better than every one of his co-stars other than Vanessa Kirby as Josephine.
Yeah, when I left, me and my buddy talked about walking out of the theater, how good Vanessa Kirby was.
She was good.
And he went as far as to say, I think if you had even shot the same scenes and edited it in a different way and called the movie Josephine and said it would have been a better movie.
Could have been. That makes sense.
I think I agree with that. And I think Joaquin was good, but she was great.
Interesting.
I'll go as far as to say that.
I found him both Vanessa Kirby and Joaquin Phoenix, very alluring. I wanted to see them react to things and... but their co-stars, everyone else, just fell so flat.
They were very forgettable.
Very. I mentioned that Joaquin Phoenix chose to play this. He and Scott, I think both of them had hands in this, chose to display Napoleon as really acting out of fear, you know, and that's just an evolutionary thing. Everything we do is traced back to fear, it seems. And so what's at play here has made fear kind of funny. I don't know. I would have loved to have gotten a couple more of those. The line delivery of the movie by far was, "You think you are so great because you have boats." I mean, that was like, give me more of that. That's what I want.
Donovan, he goes to meet a English ambassador or something like that.
The Duke of Wellington, right?
Oh, I'm sorry. Was it the Duke of Wellington?
It was either him or one of his, you know, people.
But he goes and, you know, this whole like diplomatic scene is set and Napoleon just can't contain his childish.
Childish is right. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Ridley Scott told Variety that he had to rehearse with Phoenix almost scene by scene, just one-on-one, because 2 weeks out, Joaquin Phoenix comes to him and was like, "I don't know what to do." And Ridley Scott kind of panicked and was like, "Dude, we're 2 weeks from shooting. What do you mean you don't know what to do?" He's like, "Yeah. I don't know what to do with this character." And they went through it. So I'm crediting Ridley Scott a lot, but they knew what they were doing with him. Him by that point, because when he's doing those very adolescent kind of reactions, that's on purpose and it's funny.
It was, and it kind of made him, he wasn't horrifying very often,
right?
Like, you're thinking this dude at the spoiler alert at the end, Donovan, they list how many men or just people, citizens as well, died while he was riding through the wild west of Europe or whatever.
It's quite the body count.
It is quite the body count. When you see him just fly off the handle, like in that scene that Blaine just quoted, like, it's funny on the surface, but it's also like, oh, this is like the most dangerous military tactician with the greatest land army in the world at his disposal.
Right.
God knows what he's going to do because he has a tantrum.
He might just up and invade Spain.
No, Napoleon in that era is a huge blind spot for me historically, so I did like just seeing what happens. It held some entertainment value in that sense for me.
Donovan, I have a question for you for the historical. This up very well.
I don't know if I'm going to know this.
He meets Josephine, and then Josephine sends her son to him. Mm-hmm. The son doesn't introduce himself, and he says, "I want my father's saber."
Sword.
As a keepsake. And it's a little kid, not like a... He's mm-hmm. not going to do anything with the sword. And they go, and he finds some sword to go and give the family or whatever. And then, of course, meets Josephine again. How did Napoleon survive the revolution? What was he doing? Why were officers taken out? And he was, you know, in a position to be drafting off of the events of the day and then just, you know, slingshot to emperor.
It's a little complex, and by a little complex, I mean, I don't remember it very well, but if my half remembered thing serves me is that, like, he was actually fairly politically astute. And, you know, he was working for the revolutionary government. Obviously he was not like the old guard, you know, if I remember correctly, like, he got a reputation as a problem solver, right? Like, when they have the scene where he shoots he uses the grape shot on the civilians.
Yeah.
So, like, as an early, you know, he was ambitious. He was politically astute. He knew how to play his cards right. And
see, that's what's confusing is it starts with his assault on what was the harbor town where they take the fort and then immediately use the British guns to fire on the British ships.
Mm-hmm.
And then he comes back and he's given the assignment of protecting essentially their Congress, right? That's the royalists are coming to, like, is that what you're talking about when he said use the grape shot on the civilians?
Maybe. If I remember correctly, it was rioters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're rioters. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Rioters. Yeah. And he takes care of things pretty quickly.
Yeah.
What was he, like, an artillery lieutenant? I think he was an artillery lieutenant.
He always wants to use the artillery.
Yeah.
But how did that, like, and you're at a time of, like, sometimes populist rule, right? Like, I mean, God knows what's going to happen. Like, how did he's shooting into crowds of people who stormed the Bastille not that long before. You know what I mean? Like, how do you survive mm-hmm. that?
No idea.
Okay.
Well, didn't Trump gas his own people in front of the White House? His own citizenry?
Yeah.
Okay. They're the same person, right?
You know, it is kind of interesting. And this is me really talking on my own ass. But, like, you do have, like, leaders that were able to stir up a popular movement. But, like, you never, like, they, like, the army, like, didn't just go away, right? Like, it became another tool in the hands of the people in charge, right? So, like, you know, you have, like, Robespierre and folks like that who are not really leading a popular movement anymore, but they do have people behind them.
Right. I think that's what the movie sets it out to be. You know, the people making the decisions that he's really personally fighting with are still, like, in their mansions or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know that that's, like, true to how the world works. It's just a funny, you know, to you think of the French Revolution, you think of the, you know, liberty running through the crowd with the flag or whatever. And they're mm-hmm. all posturing with the tricolor as, like, they're wrapped around them and all this stuff. It was, I don't know, that era is just so fascinating to me. And every time that I learn a little more, I realize how little I know.
Man.
I can absolutely recommend a book I read on it called The First Total War, which looks at the French Revolution as a swing point from, like, okay, like, yes, we're fighting each other. Yes, we're killing each other. But, like, I've destroyed you militarily and I've taken the things I want. Like, the war is over. Whereas, like, France is, like, in the revolution, like, the revolutionary rhetoric leads to being like, no, like, we have to destroy, like there was a part of the country that wasn't on board with the revolution, and the revolutionary government's like, no, we have to destroy this. We have to destroy this place. We have to cut out this evil. We have to root it out. Really interesting. And then talking about how the Napoleonic Wars kind of followed this logic, and we've been there pretty much ever since.
It is interesting to me that how cordial the leaders could be after the battles. I don't know if that's historically accurate, but they would sit down and go, well, you won. Okay, here you go.
I mean, after the Battle of Austerlitz, right? Like, Russia, you know, like, the Tsar and Napoleon were pals, right? Because Russia right. was like, okay, you beat us. You beat us. Guess we'll help you conquer Austria.
It was very much a sign that the army and the people are just nothing to them. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, they're tools.
Yeah, exactly. You said tools. Yeah. And it's just almost like a chessboard, and then, oh, okay, you won the game, and the pieces were people who died.
Yeah. I mean, he's a fascinating person, right? And, like, certainly not, like, a genocidal maniac or something, but just, like, his ambition mm-hmm. dragged people. And, like, obviously, he must have been an electrifying person, right? Because, like, he's, like, the spirit of the age. Like, people are writing about him, people are thinking about him, people are enthralled with him. You know, at the end of the day, he got a lot of people killed, and what was it really for?
Right.
Himself. And, you know?
Yeah. I think my issue with the film, another issue, is that none of that ever hit. None of that ever gave a clear punch.
Yeah. Even the way that we're hashing it out right now, like...
It would have been
better. You know, I already said maybe there's, like, a film called Josephine. There could be one for him where it's only him wheeling and dealing in France. Or it's only, like, one... I read nothing going into the film and was surprised when it really followed the whole arc of his success and demise, as opposed to, like, I mean, you can make, like, a 2-hour film, 2.5, 3-hour film just about marching to Russia. You know, mm-hmm. like, what is the setup here? Why are we here? Who is this human being that's forcing this to happen? Mm-hmm. And instead,
hell, the Soviets made an 8-hour film about it.
Yeah, this could have been easily a 5 or 6 episode limited series. And each episode,
yeah, it is like they tried to cram a limited series into a film instead of, like, let's do the macro through the micro kind of thing.
We complain on here a lot about the vice versa of that, the flip of that, where we get a 10 episode series and it should have been a 5. Episode or even a 2-hour movie.
Totally.
Josephine and Napoleon's love story was, for me, I know the acting was great. We agreed on that. It still missed some heft for me. It finally hit its mark during their divorce scene.
Yeah.
That's when it finally hit, like, oh, this has weight and I feel it now. Napoleon looking down again, just like a sad boy. You know, he wouldn't make eye contact with her.
Even him kind of being pushed along by events. I mean, he leaves her because he's kind of told he has to.
Yeah, it's because he's the emperor and you have to have an heir and all this.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a good movie in here somewhere, or I bet there's an even better 4-episode limited series or 5-6. I still was fine with it, though, because I kind of learned something.
Yeah, how far cannons can shoot. It was freaking great.
I do think that it is a little inaccurate. I don't believe he actually shelled the pyramids. I think the pyramids are fine.
Wait a minute. Back up. Well, that's it for this segment. We, Adam is going to bow out, and Donovan and I are going to pick up after a quick little break on some Fargo stuff. New season of Fargo. Donovan, you and,
yeah, yes, Blaine.
You and I are Fargo fans.
Man, I tell you what, first season, good. Second season, great. Third season, good. Fourth season, eh. Yeah. Fifth season, remains
that's,
to be seen.
That's where we are. Just in that's time for Thanksgiving, we had a new season of Fargo begin with 2 episodes. This fifth season's got John Hamm and Ted Lasso's Juno Temple leading the charge. Temple plays housewife Dot Lyon. John Hamm's the sheriff searching for her. That's what I knew going in a little bit, right? I knew that. It was a kidnapping, and John Hamm was a sheriff. I put my 2 and 2 together, and I came out with 5. I was wrong. Joining those two are Joe Keery from Stranger Things fame as the sheriff's kid, Gator.
Yeah,
beautiful, right?
He's great. He's actually great. Like, you just want to throttle
him. He's note perfect.
He's heinous.
Lamorne Morris, Sam Spruill, and Jennifer Jason Leigh as a politician, right? She's a politician.
Is she a politician or is she a business person? I kind of got the sense that she's in business.
Well, okay.
At first, I thought she was a politician.
But I did too, but I'm getting the sense she's supposed to be based off a politician. I think there's a real Minnesotan or Midwestern politician who did that Christmas picture with the guns.
Oh no, I remember like the guns. Yeah, was a real thing.
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay.
I don't was that Minnesota? I remember the gun like the posing with the guns.
It was a Midwestern
Christmas
politician. Yes. this season of the True Story series has creator Noah Hawley taken on the most current time period he's ever done for the show is 2019. It's interesting, quirky, funny, dark. That's Fargo for you. We'll be spoiling these first 2 episodes, which were released last week. And I think it's going to be 1 episode per week here on out on Tuesdays on FX and then the next day on Hulu. Catch up, join us. We'll probably talk about it week to week. It's quite possible. This show's really good. Noah Hawley's really good with the show at easing into the tension.
Yeah. Yeah, somebody highlighted his directing in the first episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I would agree that it is like what is it, about 10, 15 minutes of the kind of cat, maybe like 10 minutes where of the home invasion.
Uh-huh.
Is really tight.
Yeah, it is.
You want to know it. I mean, you know what's going to happen, but it kept me wanting, like, what's going to, how's she going to get out of this?
Right. No, I didn't really know what was going to happen in some cases. The best example I can give to add to yours is the way the shot lets you see the sheriff's car turn in behind the kidnappers in Juno Temple's Dot when they've gotten her. They're driving along at night and the camera is facing from the back of the truck and you see it turn in behind from a distance.
Mm-hmm.
And then the police's swirling lights and gun smoke on that very large kidnapper after some shootout. That's just amazing shots.
I think, too, so I'll let me just spoil my review. I like these first 2 episodes very much.
Yeah.
And I think part of that may be that they're not standing on their own merits so much as I didn't like some of the stuff in season 2 as much. I mean, sorry, season 4, mm-hmm. as much as I... But I just think about the first 2 episodes of season 4... like it wasn't poorly directed, but sometimes it felt like it was trying to be a little too cute. Whereas this one feels like, I don't know, like it's more back to the base. It's like, give me the scene.
Yeah.
Like make it a good scene. And I feel like they did that.
When do you feel like that was at its peak?
That's a good question, because I don't know what I would say is the
kidnapping itself.
The kidnapping. This, honestly, it's almost more of a holistic.
Yeah.
Like, I thought the scenes revealing the character of the sheriff's character were also very good. Like, just focused, deliberate, a little talky, but letting John Hamm expose who this person is.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it wasn't cute, it was good.
Very talky in a good way. I noted
absolutely.
That. I noted that. Early in the first episode, Holly wants to establish that there's a lot to be uncovered with this housewife Dot. And I was a little concerned that the first episode laid out its assignment way too well. Like, I went into the second one quite curious, like, they can't be twists and turns here. If so, it's going to run out of runway if it lasts 8 or 10 episodes. But it got me. It surprised me. Because early into the second episode, you get a part of your answer here. John Hamm's not a sheriff on the case. He is the one who caused the case. It was just a great dichotomy to see John Hamm as this sheriff who causes the trouble, the ruckus. You know, he's the sheriff with such religious fervor that he wants Dot back, an ex-wife of sorts, or maybe still married wife.
Who knows?
The dichotomy is the actually, and I'm not even sure if I'm using the right term there, but it's wonderful that we got the sheriff with the religious fervor who wants Dot back, and then you got Jennifer Jason Leigh, who's got similar religious conservative set of values, and she wants Dot not to swindle her somehow.
Yes, she's all about the money.
She's about the money, but also those conservative values are very similar in both characters.
I'm thinking about that because I do think that there's this kind of like with Jennifer with the mom, Jennifer Jason Leigh's character, right? Mm-hmm. It's very much like it manifests as like the manifestation is like, I have created this, I have accomplished this. You will not take it from me, right? Like I'm in control here. And then the sheriff kind of gets it in a similar way, but it's more like seems to be one of those who follow the far right line of thinking that says that a sheriff is really the highest elected, you know, like the sheriff is elected by the people to enforce what he lays
yeah,
out. Like there are people out here who are like, yeah, everything else is legitimate, but the sheriff illegitimate, but the sheriff. And it seems like that kind of same, we're in control. And if you try, like, it's the right way to be, and you can't tip that over.
This season of Fargo is really playing with its own mythos. It does that each season, but this one especially does a good job of it because I thought it was setting a trap in John Hamm's first real opening scene. It's the opening scene of episode 2. He's sitting there with a married couple who's obviously in an abusive relationship, the lady is. And I was thinking, okay, does this sheriff truly believe what he's espousing?
Mm-hmm.
But then you see him meet with the kidnapper immediately after, and you're like, oh no, he certainly believes that religious, misogynistic view of life.
Yeah.
Hamm's the villain. John Hamm is the villain.
It's interesting, right? Because like that kind of misogynistic, patriarchal worldview is not super duper far away from the villain of the first season, Lorne Malvo, who believes that nature is just red in tooth and claw and only the strong survive. And like, those are like not 100% the same thing, but they ain't that far apart either.
Yeah.
Right. Like with John Hamm talking about like, you know, God puts the husband in charge.
Uh-huh.
The woman is meant to be submissive. And obviously like the same way he treats people.
I mean,
right?
It was very much, he probably hit you because you weren't doing your wifely duties.
Yes, exactly.
Like,
was there
scary.
A reason?
Yeah. And then you got wonderfully note perfect Joe Keery back in his Stranger Things season 1 mode times 50,
oh,
albeit much worse. The line delivery he gives of freedom.
Yeah.
One word. Just sends it off to the stratosphere. When John Hamm's doing his law of the land speech and he's done and there is a wonderful two beats and then Joe Keery says, freedom. Like, that's the answer? Oh, okay. That's what he's talking about?
He's so great, too. Just, like, the line, like, you just want to just punch him. Like, oh, he's God. Every swaggering asshole
yes.
who is in love with power.
And they...
knows that he can do whatever he wants.
Oh, yeah.
And is happy. But also, like, you know, is obviously under daddy's thumb, too.
Yes.
Time, right? Which makes him such a...
And they build and build and build upon the stereotypes to where it's just... it's almost bombastic and very comedic. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
He's wearing the sunglasses backwards on his head.
Yes. He's got the hat.
He vapes.
The vaping.
The vaping in the hospital.
The was so pitch perfect. I don't know why.
Just chef's that kiss. Me. Chef's kiss on the vaping in the hospital without asking. Just
yes, just
how many
that
times?
Was awesome.
How many times have you seen people do this? I have seen people, maybe not in a yeah. hospital, but definitely in the house. And I looked over, like, at the owner of the house, like, what?
He
what?
He doesn't give. Yeah, he doesn't give a shit.
Hey, how about this? John Hamm's killing it, by the way. Not to disregard.
Oh, John Hamm.
Not to disregard Hamm. He says, "Oh my God, please watch episode 2 just for this, Agent. If you don't know what freedom is, I think me saying the words out loud is not going to teach you."
John Hamm is so. Like, he's being funny and scary, but, like, he never lets on, you know? Like, he, or at least for me, in these first two, or in really the second episode, like, guy's high on his own supply. He believes it. Like, he's doing such a good job of playing someone who is, like, with absolute certainty, I'm telling you the way things are.
And it's so fun to see him not be Don Draper.
Oh, yeah. No, John Draper is a cad. This person is a villain.
Don Draper was a cad with such a melancholic backstory, you just felt so sorry for him.
Yeah, yeah.
Not this guy.
Man, I props on John Hamm for being willing to show his butt on TV, and I did love that his towel when he gets out is his own campaign billboard.
Yeah, yeah, that's good. Hey,
a hard man for hard times.
Hawley loves to lean into the Coen brothers flair, and I think the line, "Does my discussing matters of state in moist repose bother you?"
Yeah.
No one can deliver that quite like a Coen Brothers character or a Noah Hawley character in this case. It even sounds Deadwoodian if you've ever watched that show. That line is so rich. I can't even say it without stuttering, and they just deliver it flawlessly. "Does my discussing matters of state in moist repose bother you?" That is an Al Swearingen line from Deadwood, or a Coen Brothers character line. Take your pick. Did you notice that both the voiceover at the beginning of episode 2 and the kidnapper proclaiming to be nihilist are both Coen Brothers references?
Yes, I did think it was funny. Especially, and the, right, like the bit where, like, she kidnapped herself. It's like some of
like
that
a
is
Big
straight, it's like, oh, okay, it's the Big Lebowski.
Yeah, they're not... doing Big Lebowski here, No Country for Old Men. What else? The Nihilist is Big Lebowski again, yeah.
Nihilist is Big Lebowski.
For sure, for sure.
It's, you know, it's funny, I enjoy the references. I almost think they're kind of, like, the Coens are probably my favorite contemporary American filmmakers.
Mm-hmm. Same.
Yes. I don't know what it is. They're just great. Like, and I love that, like, it's the Fargo has taken up, like, the weirdness and the talkiness, not in a bad way, but in a good way, of some of these characters. But I also almost think, like, the Coens are doing something totally off, different, left field than what Fargo. And, like, yeah, it's inspired by the Coens movies and stuff. Mm-hmm. But Fargo is really almost doing its own kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
which is fine. That's good.
Yeah. So this one ends with the large kidnapper stalking the deputy down and killing one of the other unnamed deputies, the brute.
Right in the throat.
Yeah. Leaving a note for the Jokiri character Gator as a warning. You know, we're looking at who's going to get Dot first, the mother-in-law politician in her own way, the large kidnapper, or the sheriff, or Gator, the ex-husband, maybe not even ex-husband, religious nut sheriff, yeah.
I think something I just popped into my head was how much I enjoyed Juno Temple's performance, especially when she's doing insane things.
Yes.
And just talking to her husband like, oh, this is completely normal.
Right.
Like when she's like booby-trapped, like home aloning the whole house.
It was.
She's like, oh, dear, don't touch that. It's electrified. She's like, what?
She...
She's like, well, if you want to spend the money. Yeah, she's so.
She turns the house.
I thought that was great.
Home Alone shit. I loved it. She was
just completely deadpan, right?
Right.
Like she's just yeah.
Right. She and then does the series always start with a definition?
No, I believe that's the first time they've done it, but I could be wrong.
Minnesota,
I did not remember. I didn't remember them doing that before this one.
I'm invested, and as much as I was invested in the first two, this season does at times feel a little paint by numbers, and I think that might be a little what you're referencing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get your large weird guy kidnapping someone again, got the mysterious wife with the backstory we don't know. Sometimes it's a husband with a backstory we don't know. So
mm-hmm.
It's definitely trying to check its boxes to get back in form, right?
I mean, if that's what it's doing, you know, bravo. I wanted to watch more of it.
That's true.
You know, like, yeah, I did feel with these first two, I'm like, oh, it is a return to form. And yet, have I seen some of these beats before? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
You know, in some ways, Holly's playing the greatest hits.
Right. And he's even borrowing heavily from Coen Brothers lore and line delivery and stuff.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But
you know, I think they're actually, I don't know, I'm interested to see where it goes, because I think that the milieu is, you know, interesting, right?
Yeah.
Like, even the way, like, the you know, neighbor against neighbor
mm-hmm.
is repeated and brought and used in different ways. I don't know, I'm interested. You know, well, first it's a cop, then it's, I almost called her Keely, Dot, you know, trying, saying it to her husband, and, you know,
uh-huh.
some of it is probably true, and some of it is probably, you know, she's got ulterior motives here.
Yeah.
Like not being re-kidnapped. But.
Yeah, exactly. And two reasons I'm still in. Obviously, I'm still in, but two reasons heavily weigh on this. Number one, the character choice of having John Hamm have nipple piercings for no reason.
Incredible.
I don't know. Well, maybe there is a reason. We just don't know it yet. And my second is the Midwestern Minnesotan reactions of the husband coming home to say, "Geez,
oh geez, hon. Oh, I threw up in the toilet. That's me." That guy is so, he's doing such a great job of just being like milk toast.
Oh, the milk toast husband.
You know?
Yes, just, those Minnesotan reactions, as David Letterman once said, "I'll take all that you got."
Yep. I feel like they're, if we're playing the greatest hits again, like the acting is solid.
Right.
The directing is very solid. You know, like I felt like those were two interesting episodes to watch on more than one level. I'm curious to see where it goes, and just, I don't know, I'll circle back around to the acting. Everyone's firing on all cylinders, pretty much.
Oh, exactly.
You know, it's pretty good.
I've been using these first two episodes to tell people to get into Fargo, maybe. Like, mm-hmm. You could start here, and then if you like this one,
could.
You could go back to you could go back to the first episode ever, yeah, season one. Especially if you've seen the movie, you might want to start
here. You need no introduction. You can just jump into these.
Yeah. There's usually a very light connection, like a very small one, and only the most careful viewers pick it out. I have to read about them on message boards.
Yeah, I mean, there's like, you know, they're all of them are in the same universe and are connected, but yeah, it doesn't really matter. You can enjoy it without getting all the nods.
Oh, yeah. And there's not even that many.
No,
it'll probably
really.
Happen around it's, episode five, and that'll be it.
I have a friend who studies crime fiction.
Really?
And how crime fiction reflects and shapes American, reflects and shapes American, like, political.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's reacting to, like, our politics. Sometimes it's forwarding them. And I told him I thought this would be really interesting for him because it is, you know, I mean, maybe it's a little on the nose, but it is putting crime and politics right at the center.
Yeah. You
know?
Were you joking when you sent me a text that said you thought it was going to comment on Joe Biden?
I did. I was joking.
Oh, okay. Because I was like,
yeah, it's more Donald Trump, I think.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You know,
because I saw that.
Because it's solidly in 2019, you know, I mean, Donald Trump and those who he admires and allies himself with, like, you know, obviously John Hamm is very much, what's that guy's name? Very much a Joe Arpaio
yeah.
type figure.
Yep.
And, you know, this may be me really reading out too much into it, but have you ever read Timothy Snyder's book on tyranny?
No, I'm aware of it.
It's good. You know, he's primarily a historian of the like 1920 to 19 whatever, mostly Eastern Europe. So he knows a lot about life under the Nazis. He knows a lot about life under the communists. Mm-hmm. And he has some really interesting things to say about when things are going bad, the role of people who have a gun and what could be asked of them, and when the militia and the police merge. And we're already seeing the militia and the police merging, in John Hamm's character. And also, this may be me really reading too much into it, but I see kind of scary overtones of militarization, like with Gator, right? Like, he's always in body armor.
Yeah.
And uniform, right? Like, he could just be hanging out. He could be in flip-flops. He doesn't need to be, you know. And so you kind of have this, like, scary things coming together. Anyway, I'm fascinated by it. I think they might not stick the landing, but I think they're possibly commenting on some really interesting and scary stuff.
Noah Hawley's a intelligent guy, so it could very well coalesce and such.
I'd say he's pretty sharp. He's smarter than I am.
Yeah. That's it for this week. We are a weekly podcast, so subscribe or follow us in your podcast app, and we'll appear in your feed every Tuesday, with the exception of an off week here and there. Follow us by searching Taking It Down Pod on Twitter, Instagram, Threads, Blue Sky, and TikTok. We're there on all. We're produced by the website The Alabama Take. You can also find really easily on social media. And you can find updates well beyond this podcast by following them. So say hello, because we have to say goodbye. I'm Donovan Ronwald, and for everyone else, remember to tip your bartender. See ya.